just got that new Jeep though.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government Consumer Protection into session. And it is Tuesday, March 22nd. Committee members, we have some public hearing and some work sessions this morning. So we have not a huge agenda, but an adequate one for us this morning. So with that, my intent is to open the first two bills concurrently. And hopefully, I think we're going to adopt an amendment to one of those bills, but not work the bill itself. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2086, concurrently with House Bill 2499. Jan, could you give us a brief brief description of House Bill 2086?
Yes. Mr. Chairs and committee members, House Bill 2086, it modifies the provisions relating to appraisal management companies, AMCs. It allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to collect from an AMC reimbursement for the actual expenses incurred in the agency's examination of the company. And it allows the department to deny, to condition, or refuse to renew an AMC's registration in addition to existing authority to suspend or revoke the registration. It allows the department to impose a civil penalty on an AMC of $15,000 per violation, with a maximum penalty for each continuing violation of $60,000. Gives the director of the department authority to investigate and publish information regarding violations. It gives the director authority to issue a cease and desist order, and it gives the department rulemaking authority. Declares an emergency effective on passage. David Tapman.
Right, and you go ahead and give us a description of House Bill 2499 now.
Mr. Chairs and committee members, House Bill 2499, it transfers the regulatory duties relating to AMCs from DCBS to the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. It requires an AMC to certify it has a system to require that appraisals are conducted independently and without coercion or influence. It modifies the dispute resolution process. Requires an AMC, when renewing its registration, to provide all of the information and certifications required in an initial application. It allows the board to adopt rules establishing audit procedures, prohibits the AMC from making certain assignments to appraisers on a panel, prohibits an AMC from prohibiting legal communication between an appraiser and other persons, prohibits an AMC from requiring an appraiser to indemnify the AMC, directs the AMC employee to notify the board if an appraiser's conduct is likely to affect the value assigned to the real estate being appraised. It directs the board to adopt rules establishing training requirements, and it adds to the board an eighth member to represent AMCs. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, and so I will give maybe a brief historical perspective from the chair's spot on these two bills for the committee members that are new, and for those that don't remember this bill from the February 2010 session, and I think Representative Matthews was on the committee, and I think Representative Wisnett was on the committee. Last February, we passed House Bill 3624 in the February session, created the regulation on AMCs through the House. And on the Senate side, the bill was modified and changed the regulating agency from the ALCB, which the House had passed, and gave it to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Since that time, there's been a lot of federal regulation from the Frank Dodd Act directing states to register AMCs, and one of the requirements of the Frank Dodd Act, as enrolled, was to make sure that the licensing agency for appraisers were the agencies that regulated AMCs and appraisal management companies. Forgive me for the acronym. So with that, this bill comes back returning that regulatory authority to the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board, and also has some other changes in the bill which are meant to make it consistent with the federal legislation that was passed. So we've been involved in a work group since, I guess, since we passed that bill last February, working on this issue for quite some time, and hopefully we'll hear from some of the stakeholders that were involved in that work group as it's brought us the -12 amendment before us today on the bill. So with that long-winded introduction of the bill and the historical perspective, I'm going to call up David Tapman. I assume you're coming up by yourself, since I don't see anybody else jumping up from your agency. And one of the reasons we're committee members were hearing 2086, that if in fact the committee chose not to pass House Bill 2499 to get us into closer compliance with federal regulation, Department of Consumer Business Services would need some adjustments to the bill we passed in February to implement their regulatory authority as it exists today. So with that, Mr. Tapman, if you'd identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee this morning.
Chair Holvey, co-chair Holvey and co-chair Wisnett, thank you. My name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And between Ms. Nordland and co-chair Holvey, you've pretty much got a summary of what my testimony is going to be. Just to start out, I feel a little bit like first runner-up at a beauty pageant. We're here with our bill, just as a backup in case something goes wrong. Just to add to the historical note, we did spend a lot of time, particularly in rulemaking, throughout the summer to try and take the bill that Co-Chair Holden just mentioned, 3624, and put some legs under it to define exactly how we're going to go about administrating this process. There were a few things we discovered that we needed, and I'll just touch on those briefly. Should we retain this, we think that would make this a better set of laws to ensure that the regulation of appraisal management companies is robust enough to do what it was set out to do. So before you, you have my written testimony on page 3. It just has some bullet points that identify the key items we wanted to address. One, we want to make sure that there's a holding out provision, and that means if somebody was to advertise as an AMC, we should be able to pick those people up as AMCs. There's a lot of confusion about who was and who wasn't to be covered. Secondly, to push this thing through last February, there wasn't a lot of clarity around fees and so forth. Clearly, one of the things we've been charged to do is go out and do examinations. In fact, we've already started doing examinations, and we think it's appropriate that we should charge. One of our key philosophies is we charge the cost causers for the costs incurred, and so we should be able to impose fees for conducting these audits. Thirdly, we want to make sure that there is a surety bond in place for everyone that gets licensed with us. We think that is the appropriate way to ensure consumer protection in that situation, or protection for those who need to pursue a surety bond. Fourthly, I want to make sure we have adequate enforcement powers, and that the bill was adopted without clarity around that. We want to be able to modify licenses if necessary and impose civil penalties, meaning financial penalties, should there be violations. These, if you will, are for the most part technical changes that we think just strengthen the bill. Should we retain it, we think this would make us, going forward, have a better shot at regulating these companies. With that, I'll stop here because I know there's a lot more testimony to be done on the other bill, and take questions if there are any.
Questions from the committee? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Talman, the $60,000, that's a big sum, but I understand it's a continuing violation. Is that, do we have other know, enforcements that go up to 60,000, is that, and it's, you know, you still, can you comment on that penalty and comment on the fact that, you know, continuing, you know, how do you separate that, or how do you define continuing violation?
Co-chairs Hovey and Wisnett, we have almost all of our enforcement programs, and we have 13 programs within the division, have comparable penalty standards. There's a per violation, which runs between $5,000 and $10,000, depending on the program, and then there's a continuing violation that runs between $20,000 and $100,000. And so 60 is somewhere in the middle of that. A continuing violation typically is one where somebody is unlicensed for a number of days and continues to do business unlicensed. And it wouldn't be a single instance where they make a mistake. It's a situation where somebody continues to do it, usually despite being notified they shouldn't do it. So we feel like that's an appropriate remedy when we've got a situation like that. I will say, on the record, typically we pursue the lower fine where it's a one-time or two-time violation and multiplied by instances rather than using the continuing violation. It's just one more tool in our toolbox.
Well, thank you for that information. So you're saying each violation they are notified and they have to acknowledge that they've received the notification. In other words, I'm looking at the guy that just really messes up and, you know, didn't know what he was doing and makes four violations that could run up to $60,000. You try not to do that, I'm assuming.
Co-chair Zahovia and Wisnett, that's correct. In fact, right now, when we went through the process of licensing, or registering as we call it, our appraisal management companies, we have sent out a round of letters, a second round of letters, and now we're going through a third round of letters. So when we are aware of somebody that we think should be licensed, or in fact we have reason to believe should be licensed, first thing we're doing is, this is a brand new program, we're doing exactly what you said. We want to put people on notice and give them the opportunity to come in out of the cold. Should they choose to ignore us, then we're going to look at the right remedy. And it may be appropriate at some point to levy a penalty of that level. Part of the penalties have to reflect, we believe, the nature of the violation.
Thank you, Mr. Tapman, and thank you as well, and your department and staff for getting this program up and running. It's been very, very useful to all the stakeholders, I believe, having DCBS go through the many public hearings and rulemaking and the roundtables you held with all the stakeholders, uncovering all the ins and outs of this legislation. So I appreciate that.
Well, it's always a pleasure to work with you, Co-Chair Hovey. And I have to go to another hearing, but I've asked Mr. Blackwell from our office to remain in case there are questions that pop up from our perspective. So he'll be in the room.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to bring up Bob Keith and Lori Egan. Good morning. If you would identify yourself for the record before you give your testimony, and I think you're here testifying on the other bill, 2499, but you're welcome to say anything about either bill if you wish.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and Co-Chair Wisner, members of the committee. My name is Bob Keith. I am the administrator, pardon me, of the appraiser certification and licensure board. This board exists as a result of a federal mandate clear back to 1989 to require that real estate appraisers meet certain qualification criteria to become licensed and certified and adhere to certain professional standards of practice. And as such, we are under federal oversight to ensure that our programs are compliant with that federal mandate. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act that Co-Chair Hovey referenced in his opening remarks amends that federal mandate to include similar activities with respect to the board's responsibilities for the oversight of the registration, regulation, and enforcement of appraisal management companies. And to the best of the board's ability at this point and other stakeholders, we believe that House Bill 2499 will bring Oregon into compliance with the federal act, the Dodd-Frank Act. The board has been involved in this process by providing information, support, more of an advisory role to Co-Chair Holvey, other legislators, and to stakeholders. And as I said, we believe that, this bill will bring Oregon into compliance with the new federal act. And the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board stands ready, willing, and able to implement and to administer House Bill 2499. And that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have now or later.
Would you like to go ahead and give your testimony, Lori?
Good morning, Co-Chairs Holvey and Wisnant. My name is Lori Egan. I'm with ProLink Solutions, and I'm going to be blissfully brief. I'm here to express support for House Bill 2499 on behalf of myself, the small AMCs that I represent, and on behalf of the National Association of Appraisers. I'm fairly familiar with this bill and of the appraisal independence provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act, and I would be happy to answer any questions that I can about either one of those. And that's all I have to say for now. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'll just ask one question that I don't think has been pointed out yet about this bill is that the timing of this is, I believe, that the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board basically takes over this program in January of 2012, I believe.
That is correct.
According to the Dash 12 amendments.
Yes.
Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Forgive me if some of this is in testimony and I don't, understanding all the elements of the AMC thing, I must admit not all of the details fail to elude me. But I did notice a few things. One, it looks like the proposed change would make the audit requirement permissive rather than mandatory. And wanted to, so what's the effect of that and why do we want to do that?
The permissive or the discretionary as opposed to mandatory compliance audits?
Yeah.
Cost is one major feature to implement that program. The board has and had authority in its existing programs to audit its regulatees, the licensed appraisers. We don't have a program that requires on a periodic basis compliance audits for that. So I think primarily it's the cost that would be involved.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow on.
My question is a little different. My question not merely how come we're doing it, I can imagine a few reasons for that, but also what's the effect of doing it? Can we imagine a consequence intended or otherwise?
I don't envision a negative consequence by not doing mandatory two-year audits. I might also mention that of the 20 other states that have already passed AMC regulation requirements, none of them have a compliance audit provision that's similar to the original bill, House Bill 3624.
Okay. Another question?
Just a moment. Let me ask a question, and I'll get back to your question. Regarding these audits, I would assume that if, in fact, you received complaints around a particular AMC, that may actually trigger an audit as opposed to doing your regular audit on these.
Yes, Chair, Co-Chair Holvey, that's correct. And rather than state it in terms of a complaint, I would say if there was a series of complaints or a pattern of conduct, that would be more likely the trigger to a full-on compliance audit. The bill does call for record-keeping requirements for appraisal management companies, and it also provides the bill the board with the authority to call for and obtain certain records.
Thank you. Continue, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And this may just be asking about the essence of the bill, and forgive, again, if it's sort of redundancy, but under current laws, I understand that the AMC must deal with complaints and disputes over an appraisal, and the bill kicks that to the lender. Am I getting that right? And if so, how come?
Well, that's a good question. One of the difficulties with the original bill is that it called for appraisers to be accountable to appraisal management companies to respond to complaints from consumers. Mm-hmm. And a more appropriate direction for that complaint to go would be from the appraiser's client, who is not, by the way, the borrower or the consumer. The role of the appraiser is to assist a lender in making a business decision. It's not to assist a homeowner to obtain a loan.
Mm-hmm.
And so the proper flow of information or chain of command would be for a request for an appraiser to make an adjustment to the appraisal, which should come from the client, which would be the appraisal management company, and then further up the food chain would be the lender, who would be the appraisal management company's client.
Last topic. That was very helpful. One other area, it looks like there was, and this may have been the interchange you had just had with Chair Holvey a moment ago, but as I understand, it looks like the proposed change removes affiliates from the requirement to register, and wanting to get understand why, you know, why we're doing that.
Would you like me to take that one?
Yes.
There is a federal exemption within the Dodd-Frank bill for wholly owned subsidiaries of federally regulated financial institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, there is only one entity that would fall under that exemption, and that is LandSafe, which is wholly owned by Bank of America. There are no other AMCs in the country that currently qualify for that exemption. There may be in the future. It may not be likely for quite some time.
Follow up. So is it that Bank of America has to register, and therefore their affiliate does not, or is it because they're federally regulated in other ways, we think there's enough scrutiny generally, and so we don't require that they register as an AMC or anything like it, and we don't require their affiliate to do that either?
Yeah. Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, their Bank of America is under intense federal scrutiny as a federally regulated institution, as is their AMC. They felt it was redundant.
Who's they?
The Fed.
Their Congress.
frankly, I would rather be regulated by the state than by the folks that regulate them. I see no issue with exempting them
mm-hmm.
from this particular state legislation. There is also precedence within other states to exempt them from state registration requirements.
And if I might, the federal regulation on this it actually exempts those subsidiaries and affiliates of federally regulated institutions, and so we are, I wouldn't say, preempted from registering those institutions under this act.
Okay. I think those are my questions.
And I think I may have that right, but there might be some bankers in the room that may want to testify to that point, or they may not. Representative Clem, question?
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. two questions, probably. Did the discussion of deletes requirement AMCs have a dispute resolution process because it would be moved to with your lender. Is that a federal requirement or is that a state policy choice? Do we have to adopt that?
Could I ask you to repeat that question mm-hmm. for me, please?
So Representative Smith was asking about the dispute resolution process, and I'm looking in the little measure summary. It says deletes requirement that AMCs have a dispute resolution process, and I understood your answer to be the lender would instead have a dispute resolution process rather than the AMC, because the correct sort of appeal would be with you and your lender, not you and the AMC, in order to keep the business relationship lines correct, I think you said.
And before you answer that, let me clarify something for Representative Clem. When we first opened the meeting, the staff measure summary is incorrect on that, and Jan corrected it when she read it, is that we haven't actually eliminated the dispute resolution process. We modified it so that the dispute resolution process needs to go from the consumer
and if it comes to the appraiser or the EMC, that it go that notification of that is required to go to the lender who is in that chain of command. It's contractually, that's the way it goes. So,
and I got that from Representative Smith's question. I understood that part that you're saying it's with the lender. It's not going away. It's moving elsewhere. But my question is that a mandatory feature of some federal law that we have to adopt, or is that that's the policy choice in front of us?
Representative Holvey, Representative Klim, the problem with the dispute resolution process as it was written in 3624 is that it required the AMC to have a dispute resolution process between a homeowner and an appraiser. The problem with that is that the appraiser-client relationship is between the appraiser and the lender. That is in the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. Perhaps that answers your question.
Well, not really. Might try again. Is there a federal law that's making us do this, or can we leave it just like it is? And then I'll make my point in just a second, but I'm trying to understand whether it's moot.
The short answer to your question is there a federal law? No. However, there's almost an effective one from the standpoint that appraisers are obligated to comply with their own professional standards. The dispute resolution process, as it was originally drafted in 3624, put the appraiser in conflict with its own standards.
Well, if I might, so let me tell you what happened to me. I feel like Forrest Gump, actually. A lot of these things seem to happen to me, and it's probably self-inflicted. So my lender, In the standardized review they were doing, this was Washington Mutual, the standardized review they were doing of their loans during the meltdown, they decided to automatically reduce everybody's home equity line of credit available by like 33% just because the rates had gone down. And so I saw that, and I didn't have any balance. I'm like, oh, okay, it's nice of them to do that. That's probably appropriate. Then they reduced it down to zero and just canceled it. Said, well, you can pay to get an appraisal to open it back up, but and we have plenty of equity, no matter how far it went down, plenty of equity. And so, really, nothing? Not $500? Nothing. No, you could pay, and you can prove that it's worth something, your house still, and you pay. So I paid, and I waited a while, actually, and I paid. It was clear they didn't want to have to do it because it was 3.25 on a HELOC, and that's not the rate anymore, but a few years had passed, and they still had to give me the original 3.25. And the appraisal came back pretty low, quite low, actually, compared to what other appraisers that I know, they looked, they did comps. So I appealed to the AMC. And because the AMC is independent, not my lender, who didn't really want me to get this loan, I don't think particularly, I pointed out multiple flaws in the appraiser's report that usually the appraiser, from what my other colleagues who are appraisers say, they don't want to have to admit that level of flaws in their report because that's their work. But they forgot to add that we had an AC. They missed one comp entirely that should have been in the system because they didn't do their homework and dig deeper, and I found the comp. So I go to the AMC and I show them all this stuff, and they write the appraiser, hey, what about all this stuff? And he comes back with some of it, and then I call the AMC again, like, hey, he didn't even answer these three questions. So then they go back, and finally he raises it up, and by, I think, out of $350,000 on the line in value, I made their little threshold by $3,500. Then I got my line of credit reopened. So I don't really want my lender controlling that process, to be honest, because they didn't want me to have the loan in the first place. It was only the AMC who I could go to because they didn't care whether, I mean, they're not the client of the lender or the appraiser in their mind. They're the person arranging for appraisals, but not supposed to be advocating for one or the other, because the concept of appraisers and banks working together is what got us into this whole mess in the first place. So we stuck this person in the middle, which a lot of appraisers don't like, by the way, because they're squeezing them and they're not making as much money as they used to. I have some sympathy for that, actually. But I don't, in my case, I didn't want the lender being the dispute resolution process person because they didn't really want me having the loan, I don't think. Otherwise, you know, I found no relief from them. I found it from the AMC.
Representative Plum, I appreciate your situation. I'm not entirely sure how to respond.
Most people aren't when I have these things, I got to tell you. Usually,
I can't tell
you Oregonians.
That for deficiencies of real estate appraisal, that's one of the reasons our agency exists, and there is a complaint process It's not a speedy process, and it's probably not something that would have been completed fast enough to resolve your loan situation. But there is accountability to the appraiser for the mistakes that they make.
Yeah, you're at DCBS?
No, sir, I'm with the appraiser certification license.
I have bad luck lately with DCBS on a different issue, so I'm glad you're not over there.
Representative Clem, since I've been working on this for a year, because I had many of these same conversations, and I just might interject that, if in fact you found the appraisal itself or the appraiser that you had a complaint with about their practices, that complaint doesn't go to the lender, would go directly to the appraisal certification licensure board if they violated any of their standards of appraisal, which are recognized by federal agencies and as appropriate appraisal methods of all of those types of standards, that a complaint on that would go to the board itself as opposed to going to the lender. So I don't know if that helps clarify anything for you, but
if I might ask them a question on that point, how often, I mean, we're not talking about gross malfeasance, so what tools do you have for a consumer to dispute fine points? Nothing, I mean, I wouldn't dispute this person's credible and everything else. I just think in this case, missed one comp, you know, didn't see the air conditioning, you know, minor things in an appraisal. Do people come to you with stuff like that?
Representative Clem, this we do have an established dispute resolution process. We always have. The AMC actually does act as an agent of the lender. So my relationship is with the lender, not with the homeowner. So the direct, the proper route is to take the dispute to the lender, then the lender would bring it to me, and I would take it to the appraiser. That would be the appropriate way of doing so. I personally, and many AMCs do have agreements with their lender clients that they may receive those complaints directly from homeowners without it having to go through the lender. Those are business decisions that are made.
Well, there are also policy decisions that are made, and we can decide how that's going to work ourselves, I think. And in, you know, in this particular case, apparently they had made a business decision that I didn't have to call, well, it's not even Washington Mutual anymore, I didn't have to call whoever it is at bottom, I forget now.
The appraiser, probably.
Yeah. I was able to just go to the AMC again, and once it was all resolved,
yes,
then the final report got sent to the lender. But I actually liked having, before the final report got sent to the lender, where they keyed right in on the figure that was below where they would have to give me my line of credit back, it all got hashed out between the appraiser and the AMC and I. But once, you know, once I was done appealing and it had got where I wanted it to, and if I hadn't, I wouldn't have. I didn't feel like the AMC was trying to help me either, to be honest. I had to call repeated times and keep nitpicking, and they're like, oh, yeah, okay, and they'd point it out to the person. It seemed to work quite well. And again, frankly, my lender was the one who, you know, I felt at least WAMU at the time didn't act in particularly good faith by telling me I had zero equity in a house that, at a bare minimum, it had at least $100,000 worth of equity, and we don't owe hardly anything on it, and it's in a nice neighborhood. It's nothing really great, but it had at least $1,000 worth of equity. I know that, and they're like, no, you pay the appraisal, and then we'll give you some equity back.
Representative Holby, Representative Clem, this is this was a known problem a few years ago. We don't see these issues all that often anymore, and as you may have noticed, Washington Mutual has been absorbed by another lending institution for many of these reasons.
Just one last comment. This was 5 months ago, and it was with their replacement lender, and it was recent. Once again, this is Forrest Gump, who just stumbles into these things repeatedly, apparently.
Other questions? Not seeing any. I don't know if you wish to make any further comments. I really appreciate all the work both of you have done on this. I know you, Lori, have spent an incredible amount of time trying to make this work for all the stakeholders involved, and appreciate your work on it. And you too, of course, Bob. So with that, I'm going to call up the next panel. We have Lana Butterfield, Wayne Richards, and Diane Forsberg.
Change lenders. They're the ones who had my HELOC. They already had my HELOC. What am I going to do?
Welcome, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and give us your testimony and answer any or make any points that you wish to make on the topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Wisnant, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and Elise Brown and I have been lobbying with a coalition of appraisers, and I bring you two of them this morning. We're going to start off with Wayne Richards.
Good morning, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, too, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Holby and Wisnant and committee members. My name is Wayne Richards. I'm an appraiser here in the state of Oregon, and I represent the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute and am represented also with the Appraiser Coalition. I'm going to make my comments brief. In February of last year, we made a diligent effort to put forth and enact House Bill 3624 for the regulation of appraisal management companies. Shortly after that, the Shortly after the enactment of that legislation, the Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Act, which changed the landscape. This required a renewed effort on the part here in Oregon to make the necessary changes to our legislation to bring it into compliance with the federal laws. Before you, you have the proposed legislation that accomplishes that goal. It better serves the consumer, the appraisal management companies, and the appraiser. As a representative of the Appraisal Institute, I'm offering, I believe you have a copy of it, a letter of support from the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute in support of House Bill 2499 and the proposed amendments. And that is the extent of my comments at this time, and I would entertain any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Diane, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Well, thank you. Good morning. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Diane Forsberg. I'm a certified residential appraiser. I currently serve as the president of the Oregon Appraisers Coalition, and I am a committee member of the Portland Rose City Chapter of the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers. The coalition is a group of Oregon-based appraisers who became alarmed by the rise of AMCs and subsequent ill effects upon the appraiser, the appraisal profession, and ultimately the consumer. To combat these efforts or these effects, we formed the Appraisers Coalition as a core entity to organize and coordinate lobbying efforts on behalf of all Oregon appraisers. The coalition has been very active and successful in bringing together our state chapters of National Appraisers Association and the unaffiliated appraiser in the state. Last year, we were instrumental in organizing support from appraisers, many real estate agents, and consumers with emails and phone calls to our elected legislators last year. Some of you may remember that, for passage of HB 3624 in a special session. Over the past few months, we've organized them in part of many stakeholder meetings to work out HB 2499, and we add our voice in support of HB 2499-12. Mr. Chair, we'd also like to place a letter on the record in support of HB 2499, pardon me, from the Portland Rose City Chapter of the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers, and also, I believe you have in front of you a letter in support from the Oregon Appraisers Coalition. Those are my remarks for today. Thank you for letting me testify and for your time, and I entertain any questions.
Any questions for this group? Not seeing any, so
I do appreciate your work on this, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
We don't have anyone else that signed up, but I do note that Kevin Christensen and Tim Martinez came in after I already grabbed the sign-up sheet, and not seeing any willingness to come forward and say anything. I'm not recognizing any opposition back there either. So, with that, anyone else that wished to testify on House Bill 2499 or 2086? Not seeing any, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2086 and close the public hearing on House Bill 2499. Committee, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2499 for the purpose of adopting the Dash 12 amendments. So I'm going to open that work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move the Dash 12s in the House Bill 2499. The Dash 12s are dated March 21st, 2011.
Representative Wisnett moves the Dash 12 amendments be adopted into House Bill 2499. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, you want to tell the committee there's a couple of small fixes we picked up yesterday that's going to be a 13, I guess?
Possibly. There could be an adjustment. There's a couple of minor, a one-word change, and we're also looking at looking into the date of transfers to make sure that the funds being transferred happen properly. We're still under discussions on that, but I think those will be minor tweaks if we go forward with those. So a discussion about the Dash 12 amendments? Seeing none. Can we have a roll call vote, please, Tamara?
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kroger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yep.
Co-Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Holby? Aye. Having received the required votes, the Dash 12 amendments adopted into House Bill 2499, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2499. And with that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3181. Jan, would you give us a description of House Bill 3181, please?
Mr. Chairs and committee members, House Bill 3181, it specifies that a permit to practice public accountancy expires if it's not renewed for 6 years. It specifies that when a permit expires, the certified public accountant, the CPA, certificate, and the public accountant, the PA, license also expires. It allows the Board of Accountancy to restore an expired permit if it determines that it has just cause, and it clarifies when the Board may grant inactive status to a licensee. Specifies that an inactive licensee must clearly state inactive next to their CPA or PA title on their business card, letterhead, or other professional documents. And you have a Dash 1 amendment before you. That specifies that a sole practitioner may not be granted the inactive status by the board, and it specifies that licensees with inactive status are subject to the statutory regulations of the accountancy board.
Thank you. And signed up, we have Keith Myers and Pat Hearn. Good morning, gentlemen. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Hoagland, Chair Wisnett. My name is Keith Myers, and members of the committee, sorry. My name is Keith Myers. I'm a certified public accountant, public practice in Portland, Oregon.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Pat Hearn, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Accountancy.
Good morning. If you'd like to give us your testimony in support or opposition to this bill, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have my prepared testimony, so I'm not going to go over that. Woodland did a good job summarizing the bill. The Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants, which I'm a member of, is in support of this bill. The bill is a bill that does two things. As Ms. Woodland said, it first provides a mechanism for the Board of Accountancy to cleanse its role of lapsed licensees that have lapsed for a variety of reasons. And it also clarifies the language for what it means for a CPA or a PA to become inactive. This is for really two different sets of licensees. The first set would be licensees who have stepped out of the public accounting role for whatever reason. It could be for family reasons to possibly, you know, deal with a growing family. They had been in public accounting for several years, and they would step out for a period of time and allows them to maintain their license in an inactive status during that period of time. Also for CPAs and PAs that are no longer serving the public accounting role because of entering retirement mode. And then it also deals with certified public accountants and public accountants that have that are employed in industry, education, and government to also allow them to become inactive. And with that, I'd open it up with any questions. Mr. Hearn, would you like to say
anything? Co-chairs, members of the committee, I would echo what Mr. Myers has stated. The Board of Accountancy did have substantial involvement with the Society of CPAs in developing the language for this bill. The Board is hopeful that it will, as Mr. Myers has indicated, clarify some ambiguities that may exist in current statute and make it easier for understand what CPAs who wish to assume an inactive status may or may not do.
Thank you. Questions from the committee on this bill? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here today. I appreciate your testimony, and I do appreciate that. And as you know, sir, I have my father, who's a CPA, retired, long-time service with Willamette Industries, still a great resource when it comes tax time. How is he impacted, or how is somebody of that nature, because he's also got a lot of friends that are in a similar situation. I hear from them on these types of bills, have not heard from them on this one, but how would they be impacted? Do they just file for inactive status? Are they still available to be used as a resource if they're not charging a fee? How would that work? Or maybe we can take that offline if it's detailed.
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, it's a good question. I'm glad you ask it, because he would be impacted from the standpoint that once an individual has stepped out of the public role, it allows them to become retired or inactive. He would be impacted that he would still be able to exercise his knowledge, especially, and his counsel, obviously, to anyone not in the public role, so family members, there'd be no problem with that. Also, allow himself to sit on boards, which I'm sure he probably has done and might continue to do, especially nonprofit boards, still allows a CPA or a PA to do that. The only thing is it would be CPA inactive. They would be required to have that on any correspondence and business cards. They would still pay a fee to the Board of Accountancy, maintain all of their professional credentials. Otherwise, I also believe that, Mr. Hearn might clarify on this, that there would be a reduced level of continuing education required at that point in time. So just allows additional flexibility for licensees who step into that role to be able to maintain.
Can you follow up? So yourself, sir, if you were to retire, would you see this as being a bill that would actually kind of clarify situations for you, and would it be seen as a win situation for you as a retired CPA?
I think that it would. I mean, it allows the CPA in that level to still remain active in a certain way without giving up his license or certification in entirety.
And last bullet, Mr. Chair.
My only
statement on that is this is a finite bill of CPAs, but there's a vast majority of experience out there with a lot of folks that have a lot of years of experience, whether it be a CPA or you're in the fire world or the police officers and whatnot. And I just want to make sure that we're not closing or slamming doors on people that have something still to offer in the industry, and we still have a way that they can still be allowed to participate in some capacity. So I appreciate your answers, and thanks, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. Appreciate that.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on his question because specifically under this bill or under current law even, could an inactive CPA give financial advice on tax matters or preparation of tax returns if they didn't do it for a fee, if they were just doing it for a nonprofit or for a friend or something like that? Does this bill allow an inactive person to do that?
Co-Chair Hovey, members of the committee, that's one of the things that we hope that this bill will achieve, is to clarify what people in that capacity may or may not do. One of the key phrases that's in here is who does not perform or offer to perform for a client services involving the use of accounting or auditing skills. And what that's intended to address is the volunteer, non-paying client relationship that a retiree may have.
So the answer to your question is yes, an inactive CPA would be able to offer those sorts of services as long as they didn't do it for a fee?
I'm Chair Hovey, I'm not 100% certain on that. I do know that if they didn't hold themselves out as a CPA while they were doing it, they would be able to. But as a CPA, I'm frankly not real clear on that at this moment. I can certainly get the answer to you before the end of the day.
Might be good to know. So, I mean, I think that inactive CPAs should know what they can and can't do at some point. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am concerned with the language of this, especially where you were just referring to it. The way I read this on page 2, that basically it's the restrictions are not limited to that. I mean, that really opens it up. So a CPA who is inactive, and especially or consulting services, they couldn't even charge me as a small business person to act as a general consultant in my business if they have an inactive status by their CPA. I mean, that's what this language is starting to say here.
Chair, hopefully Representative Cameron, my understanding of the bill is that when a CPA is dealing with a client, then they cannot be inactive, even if it's one client. Now, if they're employed by that individual or by that company, then that they are not then serving the public in a client CPA or a PA relationship. A CPA that is employed by the company to do those services can become inactive. But if they are serving the public and it is a client CPA or a client PA relationship, then they probably, well, my understanding is that they would not be able to become inactive.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. If they wanted to start a small business consulting service, they have CPA experience and other experience. Maybe they've run businesses or been involved in businesses. They would not be an employee of a particular company. They would actually be on contract for their services. Does this prevent them from being able to do that? And they're not coming in as a specifically a CPA, but they're coming in as a general business consultant with their wealth of knowledge that they've accumulated over the years. How would they be protected based on language in 9 through 12 to be able to do that? Lines 9 through 12 on page 2.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we have had recent complaints and investigations involving almost this precise sort of scenario, where a person on inactive status at a substantially reduced fee provides reporting services and other consultant, CPA type consultant services to a client such as a small nonprofit. And the board has determined upon review of those matters that the CPA was in fact providing accounting services, which they were not enabled to do so under inactive status. The intent here is to try to clarify that sort of a scenario or an opportunity for someone on inactive status.
I'm still not sure I got the question answered. So are you saying that a CPA on inactive status could not be a general business consultant to business without risking some
Chair Hovey, Representative Cameron, on inactive status for a fee, the board would see that of them providing the same service that a fully active CPA would, and it would not be permitted.
Mr. Chair, if I may. So once I'm a CPA and I decide to get out of the CPA business, I am restricted from ever being a consultant, or do I just let my license go from totally inactive to go away? Would that prevent me from...
Do you want to respond?
Representative Cameron, that becomes almost an issue of whether the CPA is holding himself out as a CPA or not. And so that would probably be more the issue in a situation like that. If that CPA is no longer holding himself out as a CPA, then doesn't become an issue of active or inactive. It's just an individual doing consulting services. And it is not a CPA that is doing those services.
Thank you.
So I'm Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly don't mean to cause a problem with this bill. I don't necessarily have any major angst, but I am curious if it might help to explain. So the permit expires if not renewed for 6 years. So then somebody has the opportunity then to say, I want to be inactive. But if they choose to continue to renew their license and they're still going to be an active CPA, can you just tell me what is the fee associated with that, and why would somebody not just want to do that on an annual basis or whatever the permits are good for? Can we just, is that relatively an easy question to answer?
Yes, it is. Co-chairs and Representative Matthews. The not renewing for 6 years refers to someone who has permitted their license to go into lapse status. That is, they haven't renewed it as either inactive or active. Okay, and there's no fee for the lapse license. The current fee for an inactive license is $50 a year. $50 a biennium. For the active practitioner, it's $160 a biennium. And if I may just follow up with that, our licensee fees in the accountancy profession are among the lowest in the country, have not been raised by the board since 1999, and I just learned last week that our fees are lower than landscapers in Oregon. So,
Representative Matthews, thank you. I appreciate that answer, because what I was struggling with initially was, okay, so somebody goes into lapse, they're still wanting to be a resource, what do they do that? And I imagine there's continuing education as well, but somebody can get back into the business if they want to do it for a fee. It's just a matter of going through the licensure board, continuing education, and getting back into compliance.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Appreciate
Mr. Cameron.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hearn, I just want you to know that my CPA's fees are not lower than my landscaper.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Was that a statement in support of raising the fees for CPAs?
No, sir. No, sir. Maybe lower the landscaper.
Oh, I guess I heard you wrong. I just have one. Let's see if I can make it a question or a comment, I'm sure. So in fact, if a CPA wants to do these things that we've been talking about in 9 through 12, giving financial advisory or consulting services or issuing reports on financial statements, management advisory, all those sorts of things. If they want to do that for a fee, the board's saying you should be active.
Yeah.
And you should pay the fee for active, and that's not being inactive. And I think that's, you know, the bottom line here is what you're trying to get after, because there could be problems with inactive people continuing to do those sorts of things, and wouldn't be fair to all those CPAs out there that are paying for active status. Can you comment on that comment?
Coach, you're hoping to be happy to. You're absolutely correct.
Okay. So, with that, any other questions, comments, or anything else? Do we have an amendment to this bill?
Yes.
That we're talking about as well? I can't remember whether we addressed it. Did we?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the Dash 1 amendment I described at the beginning, it primarily it specifies, it adds two on page 2 of who cannot have, and help me out if I get this wrong, who cannot have inactive status. A sole practitioner could not receive inactive status.
Co-Chair Hobley, wasn't it? Yes, that's clarifying language that was inserted into the bill just to make sure that everyone understood that a sole practitioner was also included in this, that a sole practitioner cannot be inactive if he's providing services to the public.
And, Mr. Chair and committee members, the Dash 1 also specifies that licensees with inactive status are still subject to the regulations of the Accountancy Board.
Thank you. And I assume that for the $160 or whatever it was, that an inactive person can become active at any time they want.
Co-Chair Holby, the inactive fee is $50 a biennium, and so for completion of required CPE and payment of the active fee, they can reinstate to active status. They can do that now, and they would continue to be able to.
And they could do that any time during the year, I
yes.
assume. All right, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Wisnett?
To make a comment, I appreciate the career field of auditors providing us our little book on filling out our taxes, which I've done the last two weekends, and I appreciate that.
Wow. You got a book?
Yeah, you didn't get a book.
Gosh.
You must have a lot of stuff to take two weekends.
So with that, no other comments. I appreciate you coming forward and answering all the tough questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3181, and committee, I'd like to go ahead and adopt the Dash 1 amendment. So with that, I'll open a work session on House Bill 3181.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 1s to House Bill 3181.
3181.
And the date on that amendment is... 3-9-11. Representative Cameron's moved the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-9-2011 into House Bill 3181. Discussion? Good. With that, I will ask for a roll call vote on the Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flynn.
Aye.
Representative
Conger.
Aye. Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Aye.
Mr.
Wisnett?
Aye.
Mr. Holgan? Aye. With that, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted to House Bill 3181, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 3181. Committee, it appears that our paperwork is not ready for the next three bills that are listed as work session. So I would like to carry over House Bill 2631 and House Bill 2924. Any discussion? I don't know that I need a motion to do that.
No. What about 2550?
2550 is going to take a little longer, so we're going to reschedule it.
Gotcha.
So with that committee, I will adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection. Enjoy your morning.